Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Kayla Williams, who served in the United States Army for 5 years as an Arab linguist, including a year in Iraq with the 101st Airborne Division. She's a member of the Army Education Advisory Committee, a fellow at the Truman National Security Project, and a former member of the VA Advisory Committee on Women Veterans. Her books include Love My Rifle More Than You, Young and Female in the U.S. Army, and her latest just out is Plenty of Time When We Get Home, Love and Recovery in the Aftermath of War. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kayla Williams.
Thank you for having me.
And just to touch on Iraq before we get into your very, very personal story, when you were with the 101st, were you ever in Fallujah?
No, I wasn't. I don't know about while we were there, but historically, over the course of the war, the Marines are more...
Sure, they're in Anbar mostly.
Yeah.
Now, I was just going to ask you, you know, just a general, when we see the black flag flying over government buildings, it does raise questions about what, you know, was it worth it?
Well, I mean, I didn't believe that we should have gone into Iraq to begin with, and seeing things fall apart once again now is, of course, tremendously depressing. The Iraqi people who I personally met while I was there wanted to tell me about the suffering that they had endured under the Ba'ath regime, but I'm not sure if we'll know for a generation or more whether what they've been left with now ended up being better.
So just to stay with Iraq, you met your husband, right, at a mountain outpost in 2003?
That's right. We were on Sinjar Mountain in northern Iraq near the border with Syria. And it was not very romantic. It's not like we could go out on dates. I was on the listening team that made up the LPOP, Listening Post Observation Post, and he was in charge of the observation team. He would bring them resupply and spell some of the guys when they went on mid-tour leave, for example. I thought he was really interesting, smart, funny, charismatic, and very handsome, but I knew we couldn't start a romantic relationship there. One night I did confess to him that I wanted to get to know him better, and he said, there's plenty of time for that when we get home. And a few months later, he was very severely wounded by a roadside bomb, or IED, improvised explosive device, that sent shrapnel through his skull under the Kevlar towards the back of his head, and it traveled forward and exited near his eye. So for several days, it sounded like I would never have that chance to get to know him better, as the prognosis for his survival was very, very low at the beginning. He did survive, emailed me once he had recovered a little bit and started to stabilize and was in a hospital back in America. We stayed in touch that way until I got home. He was released from Walter Reed Army Medical Center and sent back to Fort Campbell, our permanent duty station, just a couple of weeks before the rest of the division got back from the Middle East.
So in the period when he was just after he was hit by the IED, did you visit him in the field hospital?
No, he was evacuated to Baghdad, and then about probably a day later from Baghdad to Germany, and then from Germany back to the United States. And even if I had wanted to, there's no way that the Army would have been interested in sending me, because I mean we weren't married or anything, and
sure.
And of course they were concerned exclusively with keeping him alive and getting him to where he could be safe. So even if I had made such a request, they would not have honored it.
So there's a spark of romance, then he has this terrible accident. He's sent back to the States, and then when do you see him again?
He was injured October 17th of 2003, and then I got off the plane coming home from the Middle East on February 8th of 2004. As soon as I had my car back and had access to a phone, I called him and went and picked him up, and we started dating that night.
And did you detect a changed person?
At the beginning, it was... I was a changed person, too, so it was tough for me in those very early days to untangle what might be cognitive or psychological differences that resulted from the brain injury and the fact that he then developed severe post-traumatic stress disorder. I was so discombobulated by my own reintegration that I perhaps willfully ignored some of the early signs, or blew them off and didn't take them seriously. I really didn't know anything about brain injuries. So when he said, oh, the doctor said I'm going to be okay, I just took that at face value. And it wasn't until about a month later, when I had to go back to work — we got a month of vacation when we first got home — when I had to go back to work and my routine normalized and I stopped staying up all night drinking and partying, which a lot of people did when we first got home, and went back to a more regular regimen, and he didn't, because his unit told him to just stay home because he couldn't wear a hat, because his injury, his wound was still too fresh. He couldn't carry a weapon because of the PTSD. They told him not to come into work, and he just continued to get worse at that point. He was drinking to manage the depression and anxiety that he was feeling, and I started to see that he was unable to pay his bills, for example. The cognitive deficits made it impossible for him to manage his own finances. And that was when I started to really sense that something was profoundly wrong, which became increasingly apparent over the next few months.
And again, I'm speaking with Kayla Williams, who served in the United States Army for 5 years as an Arab linguist, including a year in Iraq with the 101st Airborne Division. She's a member of the Army Education Advisory Committee, a fellow at the Truman National Security Project, and a former member of the VA Advisory Committee on Women Veterans. Her books include Love My Rifle More Than You, Young and Female in the U.S. Army, and her latest book just out, Plenty of Time When We Get Home, Love and Recovery in the Aftermath of War. And of course, the irony of Plenty of Time When We Get Home, from what you've just told us, is the title of your book. So that kind of a brain injury, I mean, wouldn't it be pretty clear that to the medical authorities, to the VA authorities, that this was a very serious wound? I mean, the idea that somebody that would go through that was essentially allowed to sit at home and drink doesn't seem to me like particularly good follow-on.
No, it wasn't. I was astonished at what was happening. When he was released from Walter Reed, they sent him back to Fort Campbell, and he just got lost in the system. I assume that Walter Reed thought when he got back to Fort Campbell that he would be assigned to a medical holding company, but he wasn't. For some reason, he was just put back with his artillery battery, and they didn't know what to do with him, and so they just neglected him, quite frankly. I don't blame his unit leadership necessarily, because they were busy trying to prepare to go back to war, and they had no training in how to take care of somebody with these severe injuries. Brian was told when they released him from Walter Reed, well, you can walk and talk and wipe your own butt, so we really can't keep you here. There's nothing else we can do for you. Remember, this was in the very early days of the war, October 2003, the beginning of what came to be a very long war. And there was a lot still unknown about brain injuries, about post-traumatic stress disorder. If he had been injured a few years later, he would have been sent to a VA, a Department of Veterans Affairs, polytrauma center, where he would have gotten much more intensive treatment, rehabilitation, handled by a team of case managers that would have worked really closely together. And then from there, when he was sent back to Fort Campbell, would have been assigned to a warrior transition unit, a special unit that the Army developed to make sure that wounded warriors were getting adequate case management, treatment, and support navigating the complicated bureaucracy. But in those early days, those resources didn't exist, and he just slipped through the cracks. Once I saw and his mother saw that he was just spiraling downward and getting much worse away from the hospital environment, we worked to get him transferred back to Walter Reed as an outpatient, which happened in December of 2004. And so once he was back at Walter Reed, he at least was under more regular care by medical providers and in a setting where people had a better understanding of the types of injuries he had suffered, both physically and psychological.
So in terms of your relationship, you went back to your unit and he's there alone in the dark, as you described it earlier. When's the next time that you get back together?
Well, we continued to date that whole time. We were living in the same general area, and I was doing my best to help him, but not with any training and how to do so, and without any understanding of brain injuries or psychological injuries. So I was trying to help, but I didn't know how. And at the same time, I was trying to deal with my own reintegration, my own challenges in coming home from war. Then we'd been dating for about 10 months when he was sent back to Walter Reed. We stayed in touch and ended up getting married in February of 2005. And then when I left active duty, I moved to the D.C. area to join him and help him with his recovery more directly once I was both his spouse and living with him and out of the military. It's one of the reasons I chose to get out of the Army, was seeing that he wasn't getting the care that he needed and that somebody needed to kind of take over and be responsible for helping him on his road to recovery.
But in terms of this is a full-time job. I mean, what kind of financial support did you and your husband get, given that?
Well, at that point, he was still on active duty. It took mm-hmm. the military 2 years to medically retire him. And so we were getting his active duty paycheck and the housing allowance that comes along with it. Once they medically retired him, that was actually quite a shock to us, because it happened – there was no progress for so long, 2 years, and then when it happened very swiftly, and we didn't have much notice, and his paycheck was suddenly gone, and we didn't know how long it would be before the Department of Veterans Affairs processed his disability application, and the suddenness with which it happened, we both ended up on unemployment until I started working. I had a job offer, but it was taking some time for the paperwork to all go through. And that was really humiliating for both of us as combat veterans to end up on unemployment, because we didn't know how to take care of ourselves in this transition period that was not a smooth one at all. Luckily, within a couple of months, his disability paperwork had gone through and he started getting disability payments, and then my job started, and once I was working, you know, we did fine. But yeah, that was a scary transition period for both of us.
Well, but somehow you and your husband stay together. I mean, you had three children. I mean,
he calls me hard-headed.
So, you know, the attraction must have outweighed the pain, as you describe in your new book, Kayla Williams, Plenty of Time When We Get Home, Love and Recovery in the Aftermath of War. Code black, as you referred to those moments.
Yeah, the worst of his PTSD symptoms were pretty terrible. He would have some what we came to call as code black times, when the PTSD symptoms would really overpower him and he would even become violent. He was starting fights in bars, he was drinking to excess, and occasionally his violence was even directed at me. It was very frightening. Part of it was, perhaps as I mentioned, that I'm just stubborn. Part of it was the love. And also there was just, I went on a completely baseless, I had no reason to have it, but this faith that he would get better, that somehow if I tried hard enough, I could help him recover. And also there was this feeling that I couldn't leave a wounded comrade. It wasn't his fault that he got hurt. It wasn't as if he was just born a jerk. He was injured in a war that I was also in. And the thought of abandoning him to fight his demons alone was something that it's not that I didn't consider it. I did. There were times that it was bad enough that I thought about leaving, because it was very hard. But ultimately, I couldn't go through with it. And I mean, I think you've probably heard of politicians who have divorced their wives while their wives were getting breast cancer treatment, and we all think, like, oh, what an awful human being. Like, who does that, right? And it was like that for me with this as well. He had an injury. He developed psychological problems as a result of his war trauma. It seemed as if it would have been ethically wrong to just walk away when he so desperately needed somebody to help him on that road to healing.
And were you confident that you were on the road to healing, that it would, if not go away, at least be contained? Because the injury itself is so terrible. When you know, if a piece of shrapnel comes through the back of your head and comes out your eye, My God, it's amazing that he's still alive, you know?
It is, yeah. The neurosurgeon, I tracked down his neurosurgeon to interview him for the book so that I would have a better understanding of what the surgery itself was like. And the neurosurgeon actually had photos, which shocked me that he had them after all those years. And getting to see the images was really... It really was very affecting. I can't quite describe what it's like to see a photograph of my husband's brain with the skull, you know, a piece of the skull removed, so that the doctor could remove pieces of shrapnel from it. And the neurosurgeon said that when he put Brian on the plane back to Germany for further care, he believed Brian would never be functionally independent, would never be able to live on his own, take care of himself, and that he might never walk again. He might be confined to a wheelchair. If he walked, the neurosurgeon believed he would use a walker. So I didn't know that when we were going through all this. I just knew that I knew who he had been, and I had faith that he could get back to being a man that I could love. And I ended up being right. It just took maybe three times as long as I thought it would. It was hard. He didn't, because as I described, there were gaps, huge gaps in the systems of care when he was injured that I think the military and the VA have gone a long way towards fixing. But in those early, he didn't get any cognitive rehabilitation. He wasn't checked into an inpatient rehab center. So he didn't get a lot of assistance in those early days. And it wasn't until he had been medically retired and started working again, he got a job just stocking shelves at a sporting goods store, and it started to help him learn some new skills and rebuild his self-confidence that he could be a contributing member of society, that he could do something useful again. And the routine and the schedule made him stop drinking as much, and not drinking as much meant we got in fewer arguments, and he started sleeping better at night. And so we had gone through this downward spiral, getting worse and worse and worse for a period of a couple of years after his injury. And then we were able to turn the corner, and he went on a similar spiral back up the other direction, where every good thing that happened built on another good thing and added to another good thing. And so we moved in the right direction. And it took a long time, though. From the time of his injury until he read a book again, cover to cover, was 6 years. It took 6 years until he had had enough recovery of cognitive function to be able to read a book again.
So in terms of the power of love versus the healing process of the human body, and this is obviously a case of a human being going through extraordinary trauma and somehow surviving, and in the course of this struggle that you had to hold on to a relationship and to build a marriage and to have three children, give me a sense of, I mean, I'm reading between the lines here that your story is really a testament to the power of love.
Thank you for saying so. Yes, I want to communicate to people that this, although, yes, I do describe some of the worst parts, ultimately, this is a story of hope, healing, recovery, and love. And we spend a lot of time talking about post-traumatic stress disorder. And, yes, that is a very real part of the aftermath of trauma, combat or otherwise. But the flip side of that can be post-traumatic growth, that the war trauma that Brian experienced much more severely than I did, but, you know, I experienced my own challenges in combat. And that trauma set the stage for us to also exhibit a lot of growth, to develop a deeper and more profound appreciation for how lucky we are to live with tremendous privilege in modern America, to have a deeper degree of connection to our fellow human beings, and to really appreciate the what we owe to society, the society that has invested in us and helped us on our path to recovery, and that we are committed to continuing to contribute to our communities and serve in new ways.
Yeah, but what about what our society owes to you and your husband? I mean, isn't that a
Yeah, absolutely. My hope is that civilians can and those who have never served can read this book and understand more fully the types of sacrifices that our troops and military families make, and see and recognize that even though that recovery process can be a challenging and long one, we can still be contributing members of society. We can be great employees, and we're not permanently broken, but that we do, since we as a society sent our troops to war, we as a society now have an obligation to fulfill commitments to them. And the best thing when people say, what can I do to help the troops, or what can I do to help veterans, the answer is simple. You can vote. You can research what your politicians do and how they vote, and you can vote accordingly and let them know how you want them to act on your behalf. We have a commitment to take care of those who have served us, to our troops and veterans. We have a commitment now to ensure that our politicians are adequately funding and overseeing the Department of Veterans Affairs to make sure that those veterans are properly cared for in the years to come.
Well, Kayla Williams, I thank you so much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Again, I've been speaking with Kayla Williams, who served in the United States Army for 5 years as an Arab linguist, including a year in Iraq with the 101st Airborne Division. She is a member of the Army Education Advisory Committee, a fellow at the Truman National Security Project, and a former member of the VA Advisory Committee on Women's Veterans. Her books include Love My Rifle More Than You, Young and Female in the U.S. Army, and her latest book just out is Plenty of Time When We Get Home, Love and Recovery in the Aftermath of War. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. The headline.